más de tiempo.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
My expertise, as you know, is CIA, Marine Corps, three CIA secret wars. I had a position in the National Security Council in 1975 as the chief of the Angola task force running the secret war in Angola. It was the third CIA secret war I was part of. The national security law creating the National Security Council and the CIA, as you know, was passed in 1947. The CIA was given this charter to perform such other duties and function as might be necessary to the national security interests, and given a vague authority to protect its sources and methods. And I think it was in the mid-80s that I coined this phrase, the Third World War, because in my research I realized that we were not attacking the Soviet Union and the CIA's activities, we were attacking people in the Third World. And I'm going to just quickly, in the interest of time, just give you a little sense of what that means, this Third World War. Basically, it's the third, I believe, in terms of loss of life and human destruction, the third bloodiest war in all of history. They undertake to run operations in every corner of the globe. They also undertook the license of operating just totally above and beyond U.S. laws. They had a license, if you will, to kill, but also they took that to a license to smuggle drugs, a license to do all kinds of things to other people in other societies in violation of international law, our law, and every principle of nations working together for a healthier and more peaceful world. Meanwhile, again, they battled to convert the U.S. legal system in such a way that it would give them control of our society. Now, we have massive documentation of what they call the secret wars of the CIA. We don't have to guess or speculate. We had the Church Committee investigate them in 1975, gave us our first really in-depth, powerful look inside this structure. Senator Church said in the 14 years before he did his investigation that he found they had run 900 major operations and 3,000 minor operations. And if you extrapolate that over the whole period of the 40-odd years that we've had a CIA, you come up with 3,000 major operations and over 10,000 minor operations. Every one of them illegal, every one of them disruptive of the lives and societies of other peoples, and many of them bloody and gory beyond comprehension almost. Extensively, we manipulated and organized the overthrow of functioning constitutional democracies in other countries. We organized secret armies and directed them to fight in just about every continent in the world. We encouraged ethnic minorities to rise up and fight, people like the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, the Kurds in the Middle East, the Hmongs in Southeast Asia. We have organized and we still do and fund death squads in countries around the world, like the Treasury Police in El Salvador, which are responsible for most of the killing of the 50,000 people just in the 80s, and there were 70,000 before that. And orchestration, CIA secret teams, and propaganda led us directly into the Korean War. We were attacking China from the islands, Kaimoi, Matsu, Thailand, Tibet. A lot of drug trafficking involved in this, by the way, until eventually we convinced ourselves to fight the Chinese in Korea, and we had the Korean War, and 1 million people were killed. Same thing for the Vietnam War, and we have extensive documentation of how the CIA was involved at every level, or the national security complex, because it's a very cooperative thing, into manipulating the nation into the Vietnam War. And we wound up creating the Golden Triangle, in which the CIA, Air America airplanes, were flying in arms to our allies and flying back out with the heroin. We launched the largest, this is something that Jimmy Carter did, Admiral Turner brags about it, the operation in Afghanistan. Biggest single operation, I'm told, in the history of the CIA's secret wars. And sure enough, very quickly we produced the Golden Crescent, which is still the largest source of heroin perhaps in the world today. Trying to summarize this Third World War that the CIA, the U.S. National Security Complex, with the military all interwoven in it in many different ways, has been waging. Let me just put it this way. The best heads that I coordinate with studying this thing, we count at least minimum figure 6 million people who've been killed in this long 40-year war that we've waged against the people of the Third World. These are not Soviets. We have not been parachuting teams into the Soviet Union to kill and hurt and maim people, especially not since 1954 when they developed actually a capability of dropping atomic weapons on the United States. They aren't British, French, Swedes, Swiss, Belgians. We don't do bloody, gory operations in the countries of Europe. These are all people of the Third World. They're people of countries like the Congo, Vietnam, Kampuchea, Indonesia, Nicaragua, where conspicuously they nor their governments do not have the capability of doing any physical hurt to the United States. They don't have ICBMs. They don't have armies or navies. They could not hurt us if they wanted to. There has rarely been any evidence that they really wanted to. And that, in fact, is perhaps the whole point. If they had had ICBMs, we probably wouldn't have done the things to them for fear of retaliation. Cheap shots, if you will, killing people of other countries of the world who cannot defend themselves under the guise of secrecy and under the rubric of national security.
El Yankee haces, América Latina obrera, no sé por qué no lo haces. El yanqui teme a la revolución, el yanqui teme a grito, yanqui gojón, yanqui gojón. Y viene remontando el Amazonas, el grito rebelde del Carioca, y viene a unirse con su hermano, el obrero venezolano. América Latina obrera, América Latina obrera, América Latina. Levante en tus manos la bandera de la revolución, América Latina obrera, y grite con fuerza, yanqui gojón, yanqui gojón, yanqui gojón.
Gringo, gojón. Los obreros de América Latina te dicen gringo, gojón, yankee, gojón.
Levante en tus manos la bandera de la revolución, América Latina obrera, y grita con fuerza, yankee, gojón, yankee, gojón, yankee, gojón.
You're listening to Back in the USSR. You're on CFRU 93.3 FM. CFRU, that was Ali Primera with Yankee Go Home. Venezuelan folk singer Ali Primera, who sang a lot of anti-imperialist songs, that being perhaps his most iconic. And of course, before that, we had John Stockwell, former CIA agent, describing the crimes of the CIA in 1988, some of which he himself was involved in. And the reason why I play those two things back to back, very important reason. Comrades, I'd like to draw your attention to a criminal act that, had it happened under any other context other than a country that has been targeted for regime change by the United States and has been for a long time, it would immediately be condemned as a terrorist act. This criminal act that I speak of. Last Saturday in the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, a brazen attempt was made to blow up, to kill an elected president, Nicolas Maduro, the current president of Venezuela, using two drones packed with high explosives. Maduro was in the midst of a speech addressing soldiers preparing for a military parade celebrating the 81st anniversary of the Venezuelan National Guard when the attack began. Fortunately, neither of the drones hit their mark, and no one was killed in the incident, although at least seven soldiers suffered injuries when one of the drones detonated in midair after being shot down at the last minute by army snipers, close to the stage where Maduro had been standing, sending shrapnel flying in all directions. And if you see the video footage of it, you'll see people like basically stampeding, trying to get out of the way, trying to get away from the explosion. And because the president's speech at the military parade was being televised, the whole attempted assassination played out on live TV effectively. It was a close call. A very close call. And in the aftermath, Maduro issued the following statement. "They have tried to kill me today, and everything points toward the right-wing forces. The Venezuela ultra-right in alliance with the Colombian ultra-right, and the name of Juan Manuel Santos is behind this assassination attempt. Manuel Santos is the outgoing president of Colombia and a close U.S. ally, probably the closest U.S. ally of all in Latin America, whose government has received billions and billions of dollars from Washington for the so-called war on drugs, and to wage war on leftist rebel groups opposing the country's brutal and unrestrained capitalist state apparatus, which has been responsible for the assassination of literally hundreds of social and indigenous leaders in the past year alone. And in spite of immediately denying Maduro's allegations that he was somehow involved, Santos had made it clear just days before the assassination, the attempted assassination, that he, like Donald Trump, wants regime change in Venezuela and is willing to pursue that objective using any means necessary. In a public statement on June 30th, the Colombian president said he hoped Maduro's time in office would soon be coming to an end. Quote, "I hope it is tomorrow even. Colombia would be willing and ready to help in any way possible." End quote. So basically willing to help and ready to help in any way possible to end the progressive government in Venezuela, to overthrow it, to overthrow Nicolas Maduro, the one who led it, and to overthrow the Bolivarian Revolution, begun by Hugo Chavez, which Nicolas Maduro has been continuing. Now, Maduro also pointed to U.S. involvement in the assassination attempt, saying that all evidence pointed to it having been financed from Miami, where many right-wing Venezuelan exiles are based. You know, just like there are right-wing Cuban exiles based in Miami who want to overthrow the Cuban government, there are right-wing Venezuelan exiles in Miami who want to overthrow the government of Venezuela. And the U.S. backs those right-wing groups to the hilt in many cases. And although the U.S. denied that it played a role in the assassination, the Trump administration has made no secret about its desire to overthrow the government of Nicolas Maduro and destroy the Bolivarian Revolution, as I just said, and has been subjecting Venezuela to crippling economic sanctions and threatening the use of military force, while at the same time encouraging Colombia and other right-wing governments in the region to assist in further isolating Venezuela, you know, economically, politically, and what have you. Not surprisingly, the U.S. and Western governments failed to denounce the attempt on President Maduro's life. You know, this event, this crime, which would be denounced as a terrorist attack in almost any other country, you know, by the mainstream media. Instead, the mainstream media has bent over backwards trying to downplay the whole thing and to sow doubt on the events, using words such as apparent or alleged, focusing instead on the government using this alleged event to supposedly step up repression, which it has not done, but you know, that's the kind of narrative they want to spin. So instead of focusing on what these right-wing terrorists have done, you know, trying to kill an elected president of a country that has been targeted for U.S. for regime change by the United States, instead they want to try to scaremonger about what the leader of this government might do in the aftermath. You know, they're not going to focus on the actual event at all. They're not going to focus on, they're going to talk about, like, you know, the fact that, you know, this shocking crime, this brazen crime. And in the end, it is hard to tell apart the media coverage from the statements of John Bolton, you know, one of the more hawkish advisors to the U.S. president. You know, as journalist Ricardo Vaz stated in an article on VenezuelaAnalysis.com. You know, and of course, Bolton has been one of the people who's openly advocating for regime change, openly advocating for even military intervention to overthrow the government of Venezuela. And Ricardo Vaz, he cites a recent article in The Guardian, whose opening paragraph states, quote, "Venezuela's opposition has warned that President Nicolas Maduro may launch a political crackdown after he accused adversaries of attempting to assassinate him with drones loaded with explosives on Saturday." Unquote. And as Vaz points out, remarkably, it is the Venezuelan opposition, you know, takes precedence in an article describing an assassination attempt against Maduro. And he says this would be akin to a report on 9/11 opening with "Al-Qaeda warns of increased U.S. involvement in the Middle East." And then there is the usual trick of encapsulating the events under Maduro said, so that all the previous work smearing Maduro can be used to discredit this version. So the media really tried to downplay this whole assassination attempt, you know, and really went into attack mode against the Venezuelan government instead of denouncing this attempted assassination. But of course, the mask quickly came off. An anti-government group calling itself the Soldiers in T-Shirts, Soldados de Franelas, composed of military and civilian patriots, as they describe themselves, and rebels, they claimed responsibility for the attack, and they codenamed it Operation Phoenix. And Factors of Power, a Miami-based private news network, actually presented the statement of this group, which echoed demands being made by the right-wing politicians in Venezuela that include, you know, abiding by the, you know, including the demands by the right-wing political parties that Nicolas Maduro stepped down, including calls for people to take to the streets to destabilize the government, to overthrow the government. And they claimed that the assassination attempt was intended to, quote, restore the constitutional order. And then they called on the military to launch a coup to overthrow President Maduro, claiming that he was guilty of, among other things, indoctrinating children with communism. And they also threatened to make subsequent attacks. They said openly, quote, more such attempts will follow. And Patricia Polio, a Miami-based right-wing journalist and outspoken critic of the Venezuelan government, actually read this public statement issued by the claimants of this attempted assassination on the elected president of Venezuela. And Polio herself is accused of being involved in the assassination of an anti-corruption police investigator, Danilo Anderson, in 2004 in Venezuela. And she's actually wanted by Venezuelan authorities for participation in this assassination plot against an official in Venezuela, you know, years ago. And she was the one who read this statement on the airwaves on this right-wing private news channel in Miami. And of course, this Soldiers in T-Shirts group, which has never really been heard from before, they weren't the only ones to threaten the life of the elected president of Venezuela. One of the parties in the far right, Frente Amplio, a party called Primero Justicia, took to Twitter and actually threatened Maduro with actions, quote, like this one or worse. So basically the right wing, the U.S.-backed right wing, which of course I've talked about on the show before, in Venezuela, is now openly resorting to attempted assassination of elected officials, basically resorting to terrorism in their efforts to engage in regime change in Venezuela. And it's very clear that they do have support from the United States, in the sense they are able to operate in the United States, they're able to announce, openly talk about what they did in the United States. They are openly openly talking about their support for this assassination attempt, support for the assassins, you know, support for their political agenda, all this sort of stuff. They were able to do that in broad daylight in the United States. You know, advocate the overthrow of a sovereign government, advocate the assassination of an elected president, and what have you. You know, and I think that is very illuminating as to who really is behind this and what agenda this attempted assassination really serves. So I'm going to play a report from earlier this week on the Real News Network, which deals with this assassination attempt and kind of goes through some of what we know so far. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's the Real News Network, and I'm Greg Wilpert, coming to you from Quito, Ecuador. Saturday evening, an assassination attempt against the life of Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro and other high government officials was prevented in the last minute. The attack took place during a celebration of the country's military while Maduro was giving his closing speech. Two explosions took place during the live broadcast, which then abruptly ended when a military personnel scattered from the blast area. Seven people were said to have been injured. Here's the footage of what was broadcast at the time.
Vamos a apostar por el bien de nuestro país. Ha llegado la hora de la recuperación económica y necesitamos.
Vamos por la derecha.
Later, other videos surfaced from people in the crowd, which showed that two drones were involved in the attack. One drone ended up being shot in mid-air and exploding. The other drone crashed into a nearby building and caused a fire there. President Maduro quickly blamed the government of Colombia, whose president, Juan Manuel Santos, immediately denied involvement. John Bolton, the U.S. National Security Advisor, also denied involvement, even though Maduro did not accuse the U.S. for a change. Here's what Bolton told Fox News.
Well, I can say unequivocally there was no U.S. government involvement in this at all. It could be a lot of things, from a pretext set up by the Maduro regime itself to something else. He's made accusations accusing the outgoing president of Colombia of responsibility, what he calls the extreme right wing in Venezuela. That means the vast opposition to his authoritarian rule. And he's blamed unnamed financiers in the United States. These are things he's said before. You have to take them for what they're worth. If the government of Venezuela has hard information that they want to present to us that would show a potential violation of U.S. criminal law, we'll take a serious look at it. But in the meantime, I think what we really should focus on is the corruption and the oppression of the Maduro regime in Venezuela.
Joining me now from Mérida, Venezuela, to discuss the assassination attempt is Paul Dobson. Paul is a writer with the website VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Also, he is currently involved in the Venezuela Committee of International Solidarity and a number of grassroots collectives ranging from communicational projects to ecological issues, as well as in his Camino Council in Venezuela. Thanks for joining us today, Paul.
My pleasure, Greg.
So before we start, though, I should mention that for full disclosure that I'm married to Venezuela's ambassador to Ecuador. But regarding my first question, what do we know? What has been confirmed so far as to exactly what happened on Saturday evening? There were Associated Press reports on Saturday that claimed that Caracas firemen said that there was a gas explosion in a nearby apartment and that this wasn't a drone attack. Has the video footage so far debunked that claim? And what do we know about what has happened?
Yes, well, so far, as you explained in the introduction, we have a combination of official announcements from the government, from the interior minister and other members of the cabinet, as well as a series of amateur footage of people who were enjoying the spectacle of the military parade, which marked the 81st anniversary of the National Guard. When we combine all of these elements, a fairly clear picture has emerged. This picture is of a series of drones, industrial-sized drones, technically called the DJI M600 drones, which are used more commonly in for filming cinema and films. They're used to carrying large cameras and heavy weights. These drones, two drones, were downed very close to the presidential stage and exploded. One hit a building and caused a fire, as you pointed out, which was mistaken for a gas leak. And the other one exploded in midair, as the footage shows. No? Very soon after this, about an hour and a half after this attack, a Twitter account used by a right-wing grouping claimed responsibility for this attack. No? This grouping, it's not a political party, it's an anonymous Twitter account called T-Shirt Soldiers, which was founded in March 2014, claimed that they had sent the drones with C4 explosive with the objective of killing the president. No? This was reinforced shortly afterwards by a statement which was read by Venezuelan journalist Patricia Poleo, who is currently working on a private TV station in Miami, who received a statement from the same grouping, T-shirt soldiers, and read it out without making any comment. The statement read out by Patricia Poleo again claimed responsibility for the activity and elaborated a few political objectives of this grouping, which had tried to assassinate the president. Amongst these objectives were, according to them, the restoration of the constitutional order, new elections, and the formation of a transitional government. They also call Venezuelan people onto the streets, it's a direct quote, for the taking of power. They also, when we look into their political background or their orientation, little is known of who exactly is behind this group of T-shirt soldiers. But when we look at their Twitter account and their other media, we can see that they're a very extreme right-wing grouping, very anti-government, and most likely were created, organized in the 2014 violent street protests, which looked to overthrow the democratically elected government at the time.
So, Paul, the government says that it has arrested six individuals so far. Is there anything known about who they are or what their connections are?
At the moment, little has been released. The names of the citizens has been released by authorities. Suffice to say, they're not well-known personalities or politicians of any way, shape, or form. They were arrested in the state of Barinas on the highway, which basically leads from Caracas to Colombia, one of the major highways out of the country, last night and during the course of Sunday. There are still numerous citizens which the police authorities are searching for. They have published photographs and names of these citizens to help in their search for them. But as yet, little has been declared about either the financing for this campaign, for this attack, the intellectual authors, and so on.
So many analysts, though, particularly ones that are critical or opposed to the government, are saying that this attack could have been staged. Actually, that was one of the comments that John Bolton made, in order to clamp down on the opposition. What do you make of such claims?
Well, conspiracy theory is always knocking around. No, the evidence, which is what we have to base our evaluation on, I think, points generally in the same direction. Both the video footage from the audiences, the discourse from the government in this case, the statement read out in Miami, and the responsibility claim on the Twitter account all corroborate the same pieces of information. For example, they all corroborate that there were C4 explosive used. They all corroborate there were two drones used. They all corroborate what sort of drone was being used, and so on. Now there are, like I explained, there are numerous rumors knocking around of conspiracy theories, but I think we have to focus on the evidence, focus on the fact that a grouping, an anonymous grouping, has tried to kill the president. We still don't know who is behind this grouping, although all signs indicate that it is a ultra-rightist grouping of either civilian or soldier Venezuelans, who have access to finance, because the drones cost around $5,000 each, and who are looking to achieve certain political objectives, which at the moment would involve overthrowing the current government.
So, contradictorily enough, there's also others who argue that this attack shows the government's weakness. What effect do you think this incident will have on the government's ability to rule, especially in light of the extremely difficult economic situation that the country is going through at the moment with hyperinflation?
Well, as we've seen in the past, and in other parts of the world, we've seen a similar tendency. When there is a very obvious threat to the president or to the government, generally people tend to close ranks. Now, this may mean that the pro-government forces in Venezuela close ranks around Maduro, in defense of Maduro, against this very obvious threat. And one of the worries is that, as part of this process of closing ranks, the internal debate which has been going on about how to advance in the country, how to overcome this economic crisis which is going on, might be overlooked. Only a few days ago, there was a fascinating exchange between the government and a series of farmers, poor, medium-sized farmers, who marched to Caracas, marched 435 kilometers to Caracas, to say a few things to the president, which maybe his inner circle might not have said to him, about corruption, about the role of the military in the countryside, and a few other issues. These are pro-government farmers, and this is part of the internal debate which has been going on in recent weeks and months. So one of the worries is that this debate will now be overlooked because of this greater threat, let's say. And I think the government had to be very careful not to crack down on this internal debate, or not to push aside this internal debate, but rather to welcome it and to try to advance forward and out of this economic crisis.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point, and that's certainly something we want to keep an eye on for future developments. But we'll have to leave it there for now. I was speaking to Paul Dobson, a writer with VenezuelaAnalysis.com, based in Mérida, Venezuela. Thanks for having joined us today, Paul.
Thank you, Greg.
And thank you for joining the Real News Network.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And so that was the Real News Network talking about the attack. We do know in Venezuela the attempted assassination of Nicolas Maduro. And as the interview mentioned, after the attack, several arrests were made, according to Interior Minister Nestor Rivero. One of those detained had been involved in the... like all those detained had connections to right-wing groups, and virtually all of them were linked to violence previously. At least one of them had been involved in the 2014 Garimbas anti-government opposition demonstrations that involved violent barricades, shooting at bystanders, beheading motorcyclists, and a great deal more. You know, the amount of right-wing terrorism that took place in 2014 and last year, 2017, was absolutely spectacular in its horrific nature, as I've talked about on the show. And this one man, he had been released by the government in a clearly futile gesture of goodwill, just last year, and a second suspect was sought after an attack on the Paramaque Army barracks last year during an even bloodier round of Garimbas, which happened last year, which claimed over 100 lives, and. It is no surprise that militant U.S.-backed reactionaries, because all these groups basically are U.S.-backed, you know, they have, in many cases, the open support of the American administration, which is, you know, openly called for regime change in Venezuela, openly backed the right-wing opposition, never had a problem with the violent tactics or even terrorist tactics that they use. You know, never had a problem with the people that they killed, you know, or the damage they inflict upon public infrastructure or what have you. You know, they've never had a problem with any of this, and neither has the Canadian government. And this is really the a point as well, because, of course, the Canadian government was the one that was spearheading the Lima Group, this group of North and South American countries whose goal is to politically isolate and economically isolate Venezuela. And just keep putting pressure on it, which was created and really spearheaded by Canada as opposed to like the United States, you know, and basically has engaged in really hostile diplomatic and economic actions against Venezuela, really assisting the United States in tightening the siege on that country and really pursuing the agenda of regime change. You know, Canada is up to its eyes in this. And of course, it's no surprise that militant U.S.-backed reactionaries who have proven themselves more than willing to use brutal violence to attain their political goals in Venezuela, you know, ever since their attempted coup against former President Hugo Chavez in 2002, it's no surprise that they would be involved in this incident, this assassination attempt on Nicolas Maduro, you know, whose government they have long tried to overthrow. However, writing in the monthly review on August 9th, Farouk Chowdhury expresses his skepticism of this claim by this group, the so-called soldiers in T-shirts, group which claimed responsibility and whose manifesto was read out in Miami on live TV, you know, openly claiming the responsibility for the assassination plot. Farooq Chowdhury expresses his skepticism of this claim of responsibility because basically the attack was simply too sophisticated to be pulled off by just a ragtag bunch of, ex-soldiers without some kind of foreign support. And the fact that they were using expensive drones, the fact that they could get access to things like C4, which is not easy to get it, that's plastic explosive. That's military-grade stuff. That's not something that's just available to the public. You know, they had access to that. They had access to, like, you know, drones that cost $5,000 a pop, basically. You know, these industrial-strength drones that are capable of, like, heavy lifting. And their manifesto was read out in Miami. You know, in a foreign country, in the United States, openly read out on live TV, openly supported. You know, the attack was openly supported on live TV in the United States with impunity. You know, and as one commentator pointed out, the attack required, you know, significant infrastructure and trained personnel, you know, in order to use these things, in order to use these drones, in order to get them to the site to try to pull off the attack in the first place. And it was also similar to drone attack schemes practiced in Syria on Russian bases. You know, like, I mean, this is something that's happened recently. Foreign-backed terrorist groups, mostly Turkish-backed terrorist groups in Syria, have been, like, trying to bomb the main Russian airbase in Syria using drones. You know, in fact, many of them similar to the drones that were used in this attack on Nicolas Maduro. And Chowdhury says, most importantly, drones may be sold freely on the market, but they are not sold full of powerful explosives, which is why this attack cannot be linked to radical opponents, you know, who somehow just did it on their own without any sort of aid. In other words, the American Empire's fingerprints are all over this attempted assassination. You know, there must have been some involvement, you know, by the CIA, by the intelligence, American intelligence agencies, possibly operating through the intelligence agencies in Colombia or other U.S. allies in the region. And this would hardly be the first time something like that has happened in Latin America. Chowdhury points out the history of the United States and its Latin American proxies using coups, assassinations, death squads, and practically every repressive tactic in the book. You know, just like John Stockwell pointed out at the beginning of this episode back in the USSR. You know, I played, you know, the clip of him talking about the crimes of the CIA. You know, when he talked about the death squads that were used in places like El Salvador, which murdered tens of thousands of civilians in those countries, you know, trade unionists, progressive clergymen, students, basically anyone who was, like, standing up and trying to build a society where ordinary people could stand up and take control of their lives and they would not be at the mercy of this US-backed dictatorships and the multinational corporations. So the United States and its Latin American proxies have effectively murdered tens of thousands of people just in the period post-World War II, whose only crime was to resist imperialism and push for economic and political self-determination in their own countries. You know, people who wanted control of their own lands, their own resources, who didn't want to be subjected to the tyranny of the IMF and the multinational corporations, were effectively targeted for destruction. And that applies especially to the leaders of various social and political movements pushing for progressive or radical change. To name the most prominent Latin American, Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. You know, overthrown by the CIA and assassinated. Archbishop Oscar Onofre Romero in El Salvador, assassinated by the US-backed death squad. You know, while he was serving mass, and Salvador Allende in Chile, who was, of course, killed in the military coup by U.S.-backed General Augusto Pinochet, who subsequently became like the brutal dictator of Chile with U.S. support. Many leaders have been overthrown. Many progressive leaders in Latin America have been overthrown in coup d'etats supported by the United States. You know, assassination by being shot or killed in some mysterious accident has been the preferred method for most of imperial history. However, recently some newer methods are now in vogue, and they include forced exile, most recently in the case of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti, or Manuel Zelaya in Honduras, or ousting by a, quote, democracy movement, the latter being nothing more than a very well-funded marketing campaign. And this basically is what happened recently in Nicaragua, where there was an attempt to overthrow progressive president Daniel Ortega by U.S.-backed groups who were completely willing to engage in the most brutal tactics, you know, like arming themselves, killing people, attacking and burning public universities, healthcare infrastructure, you name it. They're responsible for over 100 deaths. It's actually very, very similar. You know, just this year, just in the past several months, it's very, very similar to the kind of violence we saw in Venezuela last year, where right-wing forces did the same kind of campaign of violence, but were proclaimed by the West, by the United States, by Canada, as being somehow a democracy movement, you know, up against some sort of horrific dictatorship, which of course it was not. You know, they were up against an elected government, an elected progressive government that the United States wanted to overthrow. And Chowdhury goes on to say that in assassination attempts, imperialism has historically relied on these fabricated political movements that it creates. You know, its local political lackeys. And these allies range from political parties, disgruntled elements within the targeted government and business unions, you know, to mainstream NGOs focused on various social services. It is a mobilization of social and political forces that, you know, wittingly or not, is faithful to an external master. And that certainly is the case with the right wing in Venezuela, you know, with its, you know, strong ties to Miami, strong ties to the CIA, strong ties with the National Endowment for Democracy and the State Department, and like all these kind of guys getting all this kind of support from the United States. And as someone who has read ex-CIA agent Philip Agee, you know, somebody who defected from the CIA and actually went public with what he did, you know, and he wrote a book called Inside the Company, which I've read. As someone who's read that and seen the kind of things he said about how he set up puppet movements like these in 1960s Ecuador and Uruguay to undermine and overthrow left-wing governments, you know, the current right-wing democracy movement, in quotes, in Venezuela that, you know, does things like attack maternity hospitals and burn black men to death in the streets, you know, and lynch people when it engages in violent protests. It's only the latest installment in a long and very ugly history of these kind of, you know, violent right-wing groups, U.S.-backed groups in Latin America. And in the case of Venezuela, after the defeat of the right-wing's bloody campaign of violent demonstrations last year, the U.S.-backed rightists were finding it difficult to succeed in their political fight. You know, they were failing miserably, and still are, to mobilize other social forces, utilize existing pockets of discontent, or provide any sort of inspiration. And that is the situation that leads them into terrorist activity. You know, and their increasingly violent tactics have been supported by the U.S. and most international media without question. And given this context, it should come as no surprise that an assassination attempt has been made on Nicolas Maduro's life. It's an indication of the right-wing forces in Venezuela, their failure in the political fight, you know, their failure in elections, their failure to draw in mass support, you know, their failure in the process of democracy. Now they're engaging in the most brutal, underhanded, violent, terroristic tactics imaginable. I mean, they're desperate. but they're also desperate people with the backing of the world's only superpower. I've talked about the Bolivarian Revolution on this show before. I've talked about the, you know, I've talked about the public housing, the schools, the free health clinics, the public infrastructure development driven by the needs of local people, expressed in directly elected local assemblies. You know, the expansion of democracy in Venezuela, you know, the expansion of direct democracy, of popular participation, the attempts to use Venezuela's oil wealth to benefit the nation's people as opposed to it going to the profits of Chevron and multinational oil cartels. I've talked about the efforts to empower women, campesinos, peasant farmers, Afro-Venezuelans, and indigenous people. I've talked about the efforts of people in Venezuela, of the government in Venezuela, to build a 21st century socialism in defiance of all the efforts by the United States and by the powers that be to stop them. I've talked about all these things, and none of these things has been perfect. This is in every attempt to build an alternative system in any country, anywhere in the world, in any attempt to build socialism, things get messy. And you have to deal with things like sanctions, sabotage, corruption, you know, fanatical right-wing opposition backed from abroad, you know, and supported by the mainstream media, terrorist attacks, assassination attempts, even outright invasion by imperialist forces. You know, the kind of things that Yugoslavia and Libya faced in recent decades. And Iraq and Syria. It's never easy to build something new. It's never easy to build a better society. It's never simple. It's never simple to oppose imperialism and the global capitalist system that puts profit before human life. But Venezuela, a country in struggle, is trying against all odds to build a better future for its people, where the wealth of the nation will belong to the people and not to the capitalist multinationals and their local stooges and hatchet men and assassins who try to murder and silence anyone who threatens their profits. And I want to say victory to Venezuela, victory to the Bolivarian Revolution, and solidarity to Nicolas Maduro, who survived this assassination attempt, and he's going forward. Him and his supporters, they're going forward with the process of building socialism in Venezuela, against all odds. And that is nothing short of heroic. And that is what should be celebrated. So what I want to do right now is I want to play a speech, a talk given by Taryn Fivick of Workers' World Party, one of the main communist parties in the United States, who was in Venezuela around International Women's Day earlier this year in March. And this talk basically zeroes in on the condition of women for the most part in Venezuela, but it really covers far more than that. And it's a very good snapshot. It captures it better than I can communicate it. Really what's going on in Venezuela right now. You know, in defiance of the mainstream narrative, which all just talks about, you know, dictatorship and corruption and, you know, really tries to, you know, just tries to demonize Venezuela, Venezuelan government, and really the Venezuelan people. So this is what Taryn Fivick had to say about the process of building socialism in Venezuela. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I just came back from Venezuela about less than 2 weeks ago. And I was asked to come to this forum today and give a report on the situation with women in Venezuela. And I'd like to start off with an anecdote. So I actually left Venezuela on International Working Women's Day on the 8th of March. And I was up the night before a little bit late, you know, talking with some comrades, having a little bit of rum and stuff. And as I was preparing to go to my hotel room and go to sleep to wake up the next day and start off, this person at the bar was like, you know, hey, you know, Feliz Dia Internacional de Mujer. And I was like, what? I don't, you know, my Spanish is not as good as it could be, but I hope to improve that. But at the same time, I was like, did they just wish me a happy International Women's Day? Like, that's never happened to me before, I'll be honest with you. I was kind of taken aback by it. I was like, wow, that's really awesome. Like, I've never had that before. And at the same time, when people ask me in general what it was like in Venezuela, I say, well, you know, it was really cool because as soon as you get to the airport, someone from the Ministry of Popular Power stamps your passport. And like, that's pretty good. It's like when you go to Lebanon and you got, you know, Hezbollah hanging around and stuff. So, anywho, nobody ever said life in Venezuela is perfect today, right? And I'm not here to tell you that either. But we have to bear in mind that this is one of the most oil and mineral-rich states in the Western Hemisphere, in the entire world. It is a state that is fighting for socialism, and it is only 3 hours' flight from Miami. So I would say that their steadfastness and tireless resolution in the face of sanctions, currency manipulation, criminal currency manipulation, a slimy bourgeoisie who, with support from the Pentagon, has been trying to overthrow the Bolivarian revolution via violence and intimidation, and even foreign-led and foreign-backed coup d'etats, is pretty inspiring, to say the least. I was recently in Venezuela, as you know, representing the International Action Center, and this resoluteness was on display for all 250 of us from all around the world who gathered as part of the Todos Somos Venezuela conference. That's We Are All Venezuela. This was a conference also to commemorate the fifth anniversary of Hugo Chavez's passing, so which was a very powerful moment, and I was very honored to be there. Despite the sanctions and hoarding, people there have put on their best faces, even while queuing outside their banks to avoid the rampant hyperinflation that's fueled by the State Department. Our odds here in the United States seem daunting sometimes, but the revolutionary optimism of the Chavistas in Venezuela when they're dealing with so much is really quite infectious. It's really inspiring. I got to see some of the 3 million homes that the government there has built for the poor. I got to see the CLAPS, which is where the poor get basic foodstuffs for almost free prices. And I even got to see some of what they're trying to develop in the tourist sector, including public transport. They have these really neat cable cars that go from mountain to mountain, and anyone who knows me knows I'm a big public transport nerd. So, also, did you know that Venezuela is home to the world's tallest waterfall? Because I didn't know that, but I'm really looking forward to going back and seeing it myself. So I'm supposed to speak at this forum on women and their role in the Bolivarian Revolution. And I can tell you that just like any class conflict, just like any war against imperialism, the women there are not just the backbone, but they're also on the front line. As part of this delegation, I had the honor of meeting Delcy Rodriguez, the president of the Venezuelan Constituent Assembly. And I'll be honest with you, I don't think that she could be more than 5 feet tall and 90 pounds wet, but this woman packs a rhetorical punch that had the whole of the room on their feet screaming and roaring with applause as she told us of Venezuela's advances and courageous fight against U.S. imperialism. And I saw in her incredible presence the future of Venezuela itself. But as socialists, as communists, we aren't just about who gets to stand at the podium. A woman in leadership is key, but what of our working class and oppressed sisters? Why are they so thrilled to participate in the Bolivarian Revolution? Venezuela has been praised by the United Nations and other international bodies for its efforts at gender equity. 55% of communal councils and communes are led by women. Trans women are given prominent platforms by the revolution, and were even given space to run for office openly as trans women for the National Assembly and the Constituent Assembly. As Delcy Rodriguez has said herself, the revolution is a sanctuary for women and feminism. There are contradictions, of course, especially given the situation with sanctions and the currency manipulation. LGBTQ rights are improving in Venezuela, but there is still a lot of progress to be made. But in Erika Farias, the mayor of Caracas, who is also an open and proud butch lesbian, right, with plugs this big in her ears, I see the future of Venezuela itself. And in Rumi Quintero, the prominent black trans woman and political leader and activist, I see the future of Venezuela itself. Grassroots LGBTQ groups have been able to lobby the government for change, an accomplishment that they would not see under right-wing governments. Likewise, again, abortion is still illegal in Venezuela, as it is everywhere in Latin America except for Uruguay, Mexico City, and of course, Cuba. But in socialist grassroots organizations such as RIAS, the Network for Information and Safe Abortion,